today on Against the Grain. Americans are struggling economically, and according to personal finance gurus, that's our fault. If we could just save money from small indulgences and sock it away in the stock market, we could end up millionaires. So claim the likes of Susie Orman and David Bach. But according to journalist Helene Olin, such claims are based on funny math and even funnier assumptions about America's economy and social structure. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. America is awash with gurus dispensing financial advice, from the tanned staple of public television, Susie Orman, to evangelical Christian Dave Ramsey, to Rich Dad, Poor Dad author Robert Kiyosaki, among others. But somehow, despite their advice, Americans are still struggling to get by or make enough to retire on. My guest today, journalist Helene Olin, argues that the advice on offer is not the solution, but part of the problem. She's a columnist at Slate, where she's the host of the podcast The United States of Debt, and the author of the books Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry, and The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated, both published by Portfolio. Helene, let's start by talking about the so-called latte factor, the advice given by financial gurus that if we forgo each day buying a latte and instead put that money in the stock market, we'll end up retiring millionaires. What's the history of that idea and what's wrong with it?
The latte factor is this idea, as you said, that we could, you know, if we just give up a small luxury like our daily coffee, say, we could retire multimillionaires and we will all have enough money for retirement. And therefore, if you don't, it's because you were totally frivolous and spent your money. It sort of traces back to the early 1990s. I actually traced the when Starbucks first took off, right? And I actually traced the first use of it to the early 1993 in Money Magazine, where a columnist said, "Wake up and smell the coffee." And it really went into it, sort of, you know, was around. I remember hearing it when in the late 1990s when I was writing Money Makeover for the LA Times. But it really became a thing as we know it today in 1999. When a Berkeley area financial planner, a guy named David Bach, went on to write a book because smart women finish rich. And in it, he said, "What is preventing you from retiring a millionaire?" And he pointed to the little humble latte. And he did math to show that if you just gave up a $5 latte every day, you would retire a multimillionaire. And this thing went bananas. It ended up on Oprah. There was a law school in Washington State that started a program based around it. A Canadian bank did a program around it. And to this day, everybody kind of knows it. And I went back, when I started to research Pound Foolish, I went back and took a look at it. And I have to admit, I initially took a look at it because I was just sort of curious where it had come from, because I was pretty convinced I remembered it before the book made it a huge thing. And I, as I said, I turned out to be right about that. But what I found when I went and looked at it was, first, the math was completely off. Lattes at the time were only $2.50. They weren't $5. Return is assumed an average annual rate of return in the stock market of, depending on who was calculating that day, somewhere between 10 and 12%, which is utterly ridiculous. It didn't take into account inflation and taxes. And finally, and most important, it really didn't take into account the realities of American life. What we know is that our spending on luxuries was actually going down through most of this period, partly because luxuries were getting cheaper and partly because our incomes were going down. What was going up was our spending on things like healthcare, education, and housing. And that stuff wasn't exactly susceptible to the latte factor. We weren't going to give up visiting the doctor and save for retirement.
Well, and it brings up the question, which is, what are the prospects of any of us ending up a millionaire if we're not born into wealth ourselves?
Not particularly high. The United States has one of the lowest rates of class mobility of any first world nation. When we look at surveys where they just show people what they think the income spread in our country is people will forever pick something that is essentially Sweden or Denmark. And in fact, the researchers show we're more equivalent to a South American country like Chile or Argentina. And we don't seem to realize that. And so the result is there's just this sort of enormous blame put on individuals where we think we can save our way up and go through the process, when in fact the odds are stacked against us. This also brings me to another book you didn't mention, which was called The Millionaire Next Door, which made a huge argument for this and was also based on complete junk science and was a huge bestseller in the 1990s as well.
You mentioned a moment ago regarding the latte factor that one of its origin points was to do with a piece directed at women. And that seems to be one common theme, obviously not with all of personal financial advice, but there is clearly a huge amount of financial advice that's particularly directed to women. And I wonder if you could tell me, before you tell me why you think that is the case, what the general argument is, whether it's a Susie Orman or Joan Cleveland or these other gurus who make the argument that women are in more need of financial advice than men.
Well, the argument essentially is twofold. The first part of it is that we're more financially ignorant than men. That we are, you know, just these silly ladies and we don't think about money, or we're too emotional about money, or, you know, we just don't think about it properly, right? The second argument is a recognition of the fact that we earn less than men. Our lives are, you know, we earn less, we're discriminated against, we have more checkered job histories, and we live longer than men. So we need that money in retirement more than men do. As a result, we're seen as in need of more help than men. Both of these things are highly suspect.
Tell us why.
Well, first, the evidence shows that both sexes are financially ignorant. Second, what's really going on with women and money is what I said, is basically we earn less than men, we live longer, we have children, our work histories are scattered, and so as a result, we have a harder time saving money than men, and we need it more. So the result of the industry is to ditch the blame on women and our society, I should say, and say we should be putting more money aside, even with less. We are supposed to be better than men, right? So the idea is essentially the old Ann Richards line about Ginger Rogers, about how she did everything Fred Astaire did, but backwards in high-heeled shoes. Apparently, women are supposed to do the same thing with money. And this is just utterly ridiculous when you think about it.
So why do you think then that women have been particularly targeted by female financial gurus, but not only? Why the focus? Have they identified women as a potentially lucrative market?
Yes, they have. There's a couple of things again. First, women are more likely to seek financial help than men. Men tend to be overconfident about what they know. Women are underconfident about what they know. And so the result is women are more likely to turn to a financial advisor for help. The second part is because women outlive men, they actually do have money at the end, and that this is a quite lucrative market in catering / trying to convince these elderly women to turn to the financial services sector for help. In fact, most women will fire their husband's financial advisor within a year of his death. This is fairly well known. And it's not just women, by the way. Children who inherit, I mean adult children, will also do the same thing. So there's a real practical reason to make these pitches at women. And of course, we both know that women do tend to be higher earners in the workforce than they used to be. So there's also that fact.
So let's talk about the pillars of advice that personal financial advisors dole out. Now, obviously, they set themselves apart from each other, that their advice is particularly good and special, and they have the insight into where real wealth lies. But there actually is a fair amount held in common between these high-flying personal finance advisors. So along with the notion of foregoing small personal indulgences like lattes and putting that money in the stock market to become fabulously wealthy later on, what are the other pillars that tend to be pushed by these people?
The issue is sort of this self-responsibility narrative. this sort of idea that you are fully responsible for all of this. There's very little due given to the greater economy out there. They sort of put the onus of for everything on the individual. So the problem isn't that you lost your job, it's that you didn't save enough for when you lost your job. It's not that you're running out of money in retirement, it's that you should have known to save several million dollars for retirement. And they all claim to have various secrets to get you there. What also unites an awful lot of them is a strong dose of hypocrisy. Dave Ramsey, who's a huge Bible Belt guru, for instance, yelps at people that they should live without debt and they should in almost all circumstances not declare bankruptcy, no matter what. You know, it doesn't matter if it's healthcare bills, it doesn't matter if they're unemployed, it doesn't matter if they took massive losses in the housing market, et cetera, right? In fact, who declared bankruptcy? Dave Ramsey. In fact, that was his start, is that he found it such a dreadful experience that he got on the radio and started preaching that no one else should declare bankruptcy ever, that we need to all pay down our debts. Susie Orman, who tells people to invest in the stock market, which isn't a bad thing, on the other hand, has famously said she's sort of scared of the stock market and really doesn't invest in it and puts all her money in bonds. And you see this going down the line. The other thing that unites a lot of these people, of course, is that they're making money offering you advice. And not only are they making money offering you advice, they're offering you all sorts of products. So you have Ramsey, who's telling people that they should also invest heavily in the stock market via loaded mutual funds. He's also got a network of financial advisors that he advertises. And he, has whole product lines. Susie Orman has done everything from debit cards to promoting FICO credit kits to putting out for a time an investment newsletter. And so there's a lot of double dipping going on here.
Well, how lucrative is the industry itself? Staying for a moment with these people who are these high flyers, but obviously there's also the much larger world of personal financial advice that someone might seek from someone who works in their city, obviously not the celebrity names, but on both levels, how lucrative is this?
We don't really have good numbers, which is really sort of unreal, but what we do know is the Obama administration tried to figure out how much the retirement industry was earning annually. And what they discovered is that they came to believe that our IRAs and our other retirement accounts were essentially responsible for about $17 billion in revenue annually. That was money that we invested, but was being taken off the top in various fees and whatnot by the industry.
So extremely lucrative.
Right. And that's just one part of the industry, to give you an idea.
I'm speaking with Helene Olin. She's a journalist and Slate columnist, and we're speaking to her about the personal finance industry. Now, one of the things that both local financial advisors and then the celebrity financial gurus pushed in the lead up to the financial crash of 2008 was that people should get into real estate by any means necessary. I want to ask you about that, but I wonder if you could contextualize the whole rush into real estate by telling us a bit about how home ownership changed over the course of the 20th and 21st century. Let me just finish the question there. If you could tell us about how home ownership changed over the course of the 20th and 21st centuries?
Sure. At the turn of the century, by which I mean the last century, the 19th to the 20th century, the majority of Americans weren't homeowners. And it would stay this way for many decades. The only way you could get a mortgage prior to the Great Depression was to put down about half the cost of the home. And the mortgage that you would get would have to pay it off within 5 to 10 years. As you can imagine, not a lot of people qualified for this sort of thing. So most people were renters. This changed. What happened was during the Great Depression, there was, as we probably all know from our history classes, there was a foreclosure crisis and millions of people lost their homes. And Franklin Roosevelt, in an effort to promote the housing market and stabilize it, introduced the 30-year mortgage. And it then gets another huge boost after World War II as a result of the GI Bill, which, you know, subsidized mortgages for veterans. And this, in turn, sets off a sort of home buying wave. And it is promoted, in fact, as a way of ensuring Americans believe in capitalism. The guy who founded Levittown actually has a quote, and I'm not going to remember it exactly, but he essentially says, no homeowner can be a communist, right? And so there's this huge push to put Americans in homes. Now, initially, of course, this leaves a lot of Americans out, right? Women aren't expected to own homes. You know, African Americans are certainly not expected to own homes. Their neighborhoods are, in fact, redlined, where the banks won't even lend money in these areas. But for the most part, for the majority of citizens, it sort of home ownership becomes something of an expectation. And it's promoted in different ways. By the 1990s, for instance, as the there is a push to get, finally, African Americans into the home buying market, it's also about, you know, improving your children's prospects. There are studies done that show that children whose parents are homeowners have higher achievement in school and so on. So there's sort of this push to get people into homes. But what is going on through this period up until the mid-1990s, the mid-1980s, is that it's really a traditional 30-year fixed mortgage, right? There is no, there are no fancy mortgages. There are no, you know, ninja mortgages, no doc or mortgages. There's no fancy, you know, 5% down for the most part mortgages. There's no variable interest rate mortgages. You just go to the bank and you get what Elizabeth Warren likes to call a plain vanilla mortgage. There are what we call home equity lines. They were then called second mortgages. They were relentlessly looked down upon. You were thought to be financially reckless if you got one. There were certainly not commercials promoting you should get one so you could put in a new Viking stove, say, or go on vacation. And you would have to go back into the bank and explain yourself. And if you read financial advice from the time of people like Sylvia Porter, you know, they basically sniffed and called this, you know, a very, you know, downscale practice and basically urged people not to do it. So what changes is your question. And what changes is innovation. The financial services industry begins to get the wherewithal to expand the market. They begin to initiate new, what they call product lines, like, adjustable rate mortgages. More people, there is demand from Wall Street for the securities from this stuff. And it begins to get pushed on people. By the early 1980s, you see the debut of the of people like Robert G. Allen, who are pushing that, you know, you should invest in real estate and buy multiple homes and flip them and make money. And this really goes into overdrive in 2000 as the interest rates go lower. And people like Robert Kiyosaki sort of take up the claim. This guy writes a book called Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And he says that, you know, you should buy homes with as little money down as possible and flip them and make money. And this is, other people are more responsible, but, you know, they still say, you know, home ownership is the best way to make wealth. And in some ways, they're right. If you have your one home, it is an enforced savings plan. You know, you're paying off your mortgage and at the end you have this. But as more and more people turn to their home equity lines to get by or to refix their home or to go on vacation, whatever, it sort of all fell apart. And we all know what happened in 2008. The combination of these fancy mortgages combined with people's losing jobs and the collapse of the housing market just simply tanked everything, and the foreclosure crisis commenced, basically.
Well, we're arguably at the end of another real estate cycle. Has anything changed in terms of the advice given? Have any of these, whether this is on the kind of national level of celebrity financial advisors or from what you can tell about the kind of advice that's being dispensed by your more run-of-the-mill personal financial advisors, have they been chastened in any way from what happened last time around?
Well, we now have, there is a whole new round of people who are promoting flipping houses. There are people who are on HGTV who run seminars now that you can go to around the country. But I wouldn't say chastened is the right word. What the real right word is it's become much harder to get a mortgage, partly for because of regulatory changes and partly because the banks themselves are being much more cautious. So in cities like Los Angeles, like New York, like Miami, huge percentages of the homes are being bought with all cash offers. And there is indeed quite a bit of speculation going on from what people can tell. There is also quite a bit of money coming in from other countries. Depending on the city, it's Russia is a big one, China is a big one, Miami, it's Central and South America. That is coming in, and people are sort of buying property and not necessarily even living in it.
You mentioned a few minutes ago Sylvia Porter, and I wonder if you could tell us a bit about the history of personal financial advice in the United States. Who was Sylvia Porter, and how did this massive industry bloom in her wake?
Financial advice, of course, has always been with us. That's, you know, Poor Richard's Almanac, a penny saved is a penny earned, right? And there was indeed what we would call a financial literacy movement in the late 19th and early 20th century that, among other things, was going to teach immigrants how to budget so that they wouldn't have to live in tenements. But basically, it remained quite small until the time of the Great Depression. And Sylvia Porter was the child of a widow. Her father was, I believe, a doctor or a dentist. I am blanking on which one he was. And he had died when she was a child. And the mother managed the family funds. And she loses most of the money in the stock market crash of 1929. And Sylvia Porter, who is at Hunter College at the time, studying economics, she's about 19 or 20. She's quite precocious. Decides that she is going to make sure this never happens to anybody else again. And she starts doing what we call freelance journalism and starts writing around town in New York for various places, including the New York Post, which over by the mid-1930s actually gives her a column to talk about financial issues. And it's sort of this mishmash of financial advice with economic theory, with political coverage. And over time, she kind of develops what we now call personal finance out of this. So that by, say, 1960, she is on the cover of Time magazine. And they talk about how Sylvia Porter has sort of changed financial advice.
And then how did we go from Sylvia Porter to the real proliferation of financial advice that one can get now in the United States, both the writers and the celebrity advisors, and then the more run-of-the-mill advisors? Did that change go in hand with the change in the economy, this kind of move towards financialization? Did these people in some way lead the way? How did that unfold?
After World War II, Sylvia Porter is kind of it for financial advice. And millions of Americans suddenly find themselves needing financial advice, right? Because it's coming out of the Great Depression, they're suddenly homeowners, and they turn to Sylvia Porter. And this turns, as I said, Sylvia Porter into a huge celebrity. She's on the cover of Time magazine. She's got TV. She's on TV. She's advising presidents. She advised JFK on tax cuts. Lyndon Johnson was once said, "Why can't my economist talk sense and simply like Sylvia Porter?" And she sort of becomes this big deal. And no surprise, this eventually attracts other people. And one of them is Jane Bryant Quinn, who still writes today. But what really sets this off is a combination of two things. Is first, the beginnings of the consumer movement. Ralph Nader's Unsafe at Any Speed encourages newspapers to do more and more consumer reporting, right? And like Sylvia Porter's column. And they're doing more advocacy, more bits about
you know, car dealerships are ripping you off, and how to get the best at the doctor's office, and, you know, how that sale from the department store is really a scam, and so on. Well, all of this starts to piss off advertisers enormously. As you might recall, up until the 1990s, the largest among the largest advertisers in newspapers were car dealerships and department stores. And so newspaper owners, rather desperate to keep coverage that people like, but at the same time not wanting to actually enrage their advertisers, sort of turn to this personal finance and investment stuff, not really thinking that this would in turn set off yet another wave of advertising pressure, right, by the mutual fund industry. They don't actually think it through that much, and so add another pressure to the system. At the same time, there's more demand for it because financial innovation has really taken off, as has the need for Americans to know more of this stuff. I always like to point out, when I was born in the mid-1960s, there's no ATM machines. There are no individual retirement accounts. The credit card is less than 10 years old, and a married woman would not have a right to one well into the 1970s. There's no fancy mortgages, and so on, right? So as all these things debut, people want to read about them. And so the newspapers and television and TV start to offer more and more in the way of this. And this is what sort of leads to this explosion in financial advice that we now all know, we are all now very aware of, and to us actually seems so common that we can't actually believe, when I talk about this, that there was a time when it wasn't quite like this.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Helene Olin. She is the author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. She's also the co-author of The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. She's also the host of Slate Academy's podcast, The United States of Debt. So one of the things that was striking in reading your book, Pound Foolish, was to notice that a number of the personal finance gurus, these big celebrities, came out of all places, Berkeley, California, where this program happens to originate. Susie Orman, David Bach. Is there a reason for that, or is that just a coincidence?
You know, I've always wondered about this, and I do think there is a reason for it. Personal finance is essentially the bastard stepchild of the self-help movement. Americans forever have a weakness for self-help, as we all know. But self-help itself sort of becomes a big thing in the 1930s, like when Sylvia Porter invented what we now call personal finance. As people were engaged in trying to figure out what had gone wrong, you start to see all these different strains of thought. For most of us, we think of fascism and communism. But in fact, you know, it was also the era of everything from Napoleon Hill's Think and Grow Rich, which was essentially the secret for the Depression era, where your attitude was why you didn't have money, to stuff like Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. These were huge bestsellers in the 1930s, right? And so when personal finance, as part of the self-help movement, what happens is at some point it kind of starts to merge into the scene in Berkeley. And most of this is actually as a result of Susie Orman, who I'm sure I don't have to tell any listener who Susie Orman is, right? So, but Susie Orman is one of these people who sort of washes into the Bay Area in the early 1970s. She's one semester short of graduating from University of Illinois, if I'm remembering correctly. And she goes out there and she begins to waitress at the Buttercup Cafe, which I don't believe exists anymore. And at one point tells her customers how much she really wants to open her own restaurant. And Susie, like then as in now, is quite ingratiating and popular, and people really like her. So the customers get together and raise, I believe, $50,000 for her to open this restaurant. And she gives it to a broker at a brokerage house, and who promptly invests in some scam of some sort or another and loses most of the money. And Susie, being Susie, doesn't just take this sitting down. She marches in and demands a job as a financial advisor. And lo and behold, they give it to her. And she knows so little about financial advice, even though she's passed her initial exams when she starts the job, she actually turns up with a crystal. And this is how she determines what she tells her initial clients how to invest, which is one of those little details I've always loved. But in any case, she begins to build her practice, first by catering to lower income and middle income people, which is something that most people in the financial industry don't actually do. They actually want the big bucks, right? So she's got this specialty. And at the same time, of course, she is still quite active in various and sundry self-help movements and spiritual movements that are very common in Berkeley. And by this time, it's the mid-1980s. And when she starts to write about personal finance, she sort of combines all of these strains of it so that it's like this combination of practical advice with this heavy dose of self-actualization. And so when she publishes The Courage to be Rich, which is her sort of breakout book in 1997, reviewers were just agog. They literally never seen anything like it. And this in turn sort of revolutionizes personal finance advice as far as the guru quotient goes.
So you've been discussing how the business of personal financial advice grew and grew from the 1930s and then really exploded in the 1990s and after that. And I wonder if you could talk about something that you've been touching on in bits and pieces, but if you could bring the threads together for us. What happened in the 80s and 90s and through to the present in the larger economy that paralleled so nicely this explosion of personal financial advice?
Income inequality, wealth inequality. What happens is our salaries start to not, the income divide begins to open up. And most of us are not keeping pace with the rising cost of living. Because what starts to happen is the cost, as this income inequality opens up, the cost of the things, what I like to say, of the things you can't live without, healthcare, housing, education, go up at rates double that of inflation, sometimes more than double that of inflation when it comes to health care and housing, not for a period of years, but for a period of decades. And so the result is you literally see personal finance and investment advice pitched at people as a way around this. And I have to say, it was at first very subtly done. And even when I pitched Pound Foolish, I wasn't totally convinced it had been done fully explicitly that way. But when I then went back and started rereading stuff, I would actually find articles that actually pitched it as such, that income inequality is growing and wealth inequality is growing. And you are almost, the only way you can get out of this is to invest your way out of this. And there's one fairly famous one, mostly thanks to me, who found it, from Money Magazine from 2005, about using real estate to invest your way out of income inequality. And it actually says, this isn't for the faint-hearted.
But it seems like there's also another deeper dynamic that is happening as well, which is as the cost of living goes up, as the social safety net is falling apart, and as all this advice is being offered as an alternative to having that social safety net and having the cost of a living soar, at the same time, the processes that you were discussing to do with the housing market seem to have unfolded in a much bigger way over the last 30 years, which is that people have found themselves also much deeper into finance than ever before, so that to get a mortgage then actually involves getting tangled up in finance in a way that would have seemed quite unusual before, and people investing individually in the stock market, the enormous change that happened with retirement. Could you spell out that dimension of the story, the kind of increasing financialization of the economy?
Sure. And I love a radio program that lets me use the word financialization. I just have to say that. This is a huge chunk of the story as well, is essentially as our social safety net shredded in this country, and as, you know, it became harder and harder to get ahead, the explosion in financial advice and in the idea that you could do this all on your own went the other direction. so that everybody was pitched at this idea that, yes, it's getting harder, but you should be able to surmount this. And the financialization of the economy, which is this sort of the taking away of the pensions and replacing them with 401ks, for instance, is pitched at people as, you'll do better taking care of it on your own than that, you know, that shoddy government that doesn't know that much of what they're doing can do for you. And I should say this is a huge, huge part of the story, particularly when it comes to retirement accounts. You know, in the early 1980s, roughly two-thirds of us were eligible for pensions. That doesn't mean we always got them because you had to stay at work 20 years. Or 10 years, the law changes at a certain point. And of course, many people don't do that. But in theory, you know, a good percentage of us at least could get those to supplement our Social Security check. This starts to go away as a result of something called the 401k, which is, by the way, one of the great, great accidents of history. Can I talk about this for a minute?
Please do.
Okay, because most people don't know that much about this anymore because we so, again, take our 401ks for granted. 401ks, of course, or 403bs, if you work for the private sector, are the do-it-yourself retirement accounts that came in to replace pensions. And when they were initially established, they basically started in the late 1970s as a tax dodge. And I mean that quite literally. They were put into the tax code in Section 401k, which is where they get their name from, as a way that high-earning executive corporate executives can put away more of their salary and not pay taxes on them. And this was all it was meant for, was these very high-end executives at places like Kodak and such. And in the early 1980s, an actuarial guy named Ted Benna gets the idea that this really isn't very fair and that all employees should be able to access this really nifty 401k thing. And he takes his case to the Reagan administration. And as you can imagine, the Reagan administration just thought this was a grand idea that people should be able to invest on their own in the stock market, and approves Benna's idea. And this opens up the 401k to millions of people in the early 1980s. And this, of course, has come on top of the debut of the individual retirement account in the late 1970s, which was also meant to supplement Social Security, but was with your own, you know, with not with your salary as before you got hold of it, but afterwards. And so the combination of these two of these things sort of drives the personal finance market and drives the explosion in advice. Now, what nobody foresaw is that, or very few people, I should say, foresaw, was that the 401k would kill the pension, essentially. In fact, if you go back and look at articles from the 1980s, you will see, early 1980s, you'll see assurances over and over again that this would not happen when someone would raise the concern. The thought was is that this would be offered as a supplement for pensions, much the way the individual retirement account was offered by the federal government as a supplement for Social Security. And that, as we know, is not the case. Today, less than 10% of workers in the private sector are even eligible for a pension. I'm not sure, I'm certainly not. And it really sort of took over. And then it would be promoted as, well, this will increase the American savings rate. American savings rate in the early 1980s was about 10%. At the time, Europeans and Canadians were saving more, closer to 20%. Americans have historically not been great savers. And the thought people would promote this as, oh, 401k will improve our savings. Well, what happens over the next decade? As income inequality starts to come up, go up, as the cost of housing, healthcare, and education starts to soar, the American savings rate begins to crash. And by the early 1990s, it's in the low single digits. And in fact, by the mid-2000s, it is basically negative. It is about at 0%. The 401k did not increase anybody's savings, but that didn't stop people from promoting it as such.
Amazing story. Helene Olin is my guest. She's the author of The Index Card and Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. My name is Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you've been discussing all the ways that the economy has been transformed, how people's individual economic stability has been undercut, and then the advent of personal financial advisors offering all sorts of get-rich-quick schemes in the absence of a social safety net, traditional pensions, and other things that had sustained people in the past. So then the question is, you know, what is to be done? And one of the things that has been promoted a good deal of late has been financial literacy, which, you know, sounds like a good thing. What's wrong with that?
Oh, God, I always feel like such a crab here. Bad-mouthing financial literacy is up there with bad-mouthing apple pie. Financial literacy is this idea that we're going to teach Americans how to manage their finances, right? That the problem isn't the economy. The problem isn't these complex financial products. The problem is that Americans are financially ignorant and they don't know what they're doing. And if they just take a class, they'll be okay, right? And this is something that also has been around for a long time, but really, again, goes into overdrive in the early 1990s. And the reason it goes into overdrive is because Ford Motor Credit begins to offer subprime loans. As you probably know, Henry Ford, the founder of Ford, was notoriously anti-credit and really had to even be pushed to even offer, you know, installment plans to buy the original Ford cars. But by the mid-1990s, Ford could really be described as a financial company with a car automotive piece attached to it. And so they begin to offer these subprime auto loans, that is, you know, loans to people who aren't exactly pristine risks. And they get some pushback from it because, of course, it's Henry Ford and Ford Motor, Ford. And, you know, why is Ford getting into this shady business? And they come up with executives there come up with the idea of promoting how to manage these loans. And they fund begin to fund financial literacy efforts. Most famously, the one that became known as Jumpstart. And in fact, if you look at their first effort, it is indeed an auto loan commercial. Then they get the great idea to push into children's financial literacy. And this just dovetails perfectly with the rise of, in the late 1990s, of, you know, all the scare stuff about how, you know, children need to be reached by the age of three, or, you know, we'll never be able to teach them stuff. And, you know, we're falling behind here in the United States. And they promote financial literacy. And they have this real flair for publicity. A professor at Marquette and SUNY Buffalo named Lou Mandel, a behavioral economist, gets involved with this, and he devises a test where he tests kids on financial literacy every year. And they, of course, come up with the fact that, you know, American kids barely know anything. And they test kids after they take a class in financial literacy. And over several years of looking at these studies, Mandel comes to realize that taking a class in financial literacy doesn't seem to do much of anything for anybody. And he says so. And Jumpstart's response is to go find new researchers. And then during the crisis, and this is around the time of 2008, 2009, and during the financial crisis, the banks begin to seize on financial literacy as well, which they've always been promoting, mind you. I don't want to say they hadn't been promoting it in the past 10 years, but they really seize on it as a sort of distraction almost from the crisis. So instead of the fact it was that, you know, you signed mortgage papers you didn't understand and you were led to them or you were misled to it, it was, gee, you know, why didn't you understand what you were signing? Why didn't you read this 100-page mortgage with, you know, single spaced with small type? This is all your fault. And so the banks began to promote the idea that that Americans should be just educated and that they would totally get, you know, these financial things that were being marketed at them. But of course, more and more studies were done, and the studies seemed to come back saying the same thing. Over and over again, you would see studies that would say people take a class of this stuff and they promptly forget everything they learn within a few months to a year, or that there's simply no difference in what people who take these classes, you know about financial matters versus don't. And in fact, when you think about it, the whole thing was just absurd because, of course, the whole idea that you would just take one class in financial literacy and be fine for the rest of your life has to be crazy, right? I mean, try to remember what you learned in high school and good luck to you. So now the whole idea is this thing called just-in-time financial literacy, which is they'll get you at the moment, right? So they'll sit you down with somebody, you know, when you're going to buy a house and they'll explain a mortgage to you. And there's lots of problems with this too, starting with the fact that, again, most people's financial problems aren't that they don't know enough, it's that they don't have enough money. Second, these are long, complicated processes, and sitting down with somebody when they want to buy a house isn't exactly helpful you know, if they don't have the money for a 30-year fixed loan, for instance. And third, it is that, you know, there is no standards really here. And this is a huge part of the issue, too, is pretty much anybody could set themselves up and say that they're teaching financial literacy. So, you know, I've looked at financial literacy curriculums devised by auto loan companies that don't mention what a subprime auto loan is and why you should avoid it. I have looked at credit card financial literacy initiatives that have actually said things like, you know, credit cards can help you at a pinch and they're a good use for emergency spending. I have seen financial gurus like Dave Ramsey. He has his own network of personal financial advisors. And his financial literacy thing doesn't mention the fact that index funds tend to perform better than managed mutual funds.
Well, so given what you've just said, given that the problem that most of us face is that we don't have enough money rather than enough information, why is it that you have, along with University of Chicago professor Harold Pollack, put out a book called The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated? And the premise of the book is that all you need to know about personal finance could fit on an index card at, I think, 10 key points.
This is sort of a very funny story. When I wrote Pound Foolish, I felt for sure no one would ever ask me to write financial advice again. Because I basically just said most of this is complete garbage, right? And I should say I got my start doing this by writing the Money Makeover column for the Los Angeles Times in the late 90s. So I thought for sure that would be the end of my career in personal finance. And I was pretty okay with that because I hadn't actually been doing it for a while, except on this sort of writing about it as a big picture level. And what happened was, is that people began asking me for financial advice. A lot of people read Pound Foolish, said, thank you for writing this. Thank you for reflecting my reality. But Helene, I've got a 401k and what should I do with it? And I don't know what to do. And you seem honest. I was as shocked as anybody by this, by the way. And it happened over and over again. And while in my heart of hearts, I would like to see the 401k go away, for instance, I am a deep believer in the expansion of Social Security and in things like California Secure Choice, I should say. I also recognize the fact that people live in the American system. The promised land of expanded Social Security is not coming tomorrow, if ever, and that they do need guidance. And so the index card was kind of a response to that, to sort of cut through the clutter and give people the best guidance and the best advice I could so that they wouldn't feel, as some did, that I had sort of left them hanging, that I had said, well, all of this doesn't work, but I hadn't exactly given them a solution to it. And that was my effort at it.
Well, let's talk about, in the time that we have remaining, the key points that you and your co-author make. Some of them are social, some of them are individual. So in terms of the basics, what do you think people should do, given that, as you say, people do live in this reality, struggling as they are, many of them, and given that the onus of getting through mainly has been put on the shoulders of individuals?
Well, I mean, the first thing we talk about is saving, and that we urge people to try to strive and save 10 to 20% of their income. And I don't want to come off as a hypocrite, by the way. I strive as well, by the way. The word strive is very deliberate here. Because one of the things I found over the years is, you know, one of the things about personal finance advice is while people who are writing it seem to think this is all common sense and they don't know why people don't know this, in fact, people don't have a clue. And so I would have people say to me, oh, I should be saving 5%. I'd have other people say to me, they should be saving 50%. I have somebody who wrote to me at Slate the other day and said her husband wants to save 75%. People literally don't know what to save. And so the best advice is really to try to save 10 to 20% of your income. I also realize that for many, many people, that is just simply not possible. So that is the first one. The second one, of course, is not to maintain credit card balances. Again, to me and to people who write personal finance, that seems like common sense. But a lot of people will actually do things like, you know, keep several thousand dollars in the bank in case of emergency while floating a, you know, several thousand dollar balance on their credit card. That is a really good way to lose money because your money in the bank is earning about 1%, if that. Credit card interest rates can be anywhere from 15% to 30%, if not higher, depending on what year we're talking about. And then, of course, the sort of heart of the book was really the investment advice. And I want to make it clear that this is really for people who have the money to invest. But it was very much my attempt to stop the shoddy financial advisors who sort of try to, you know, make their living by telling people they've got the secret and that they can trump the stock market. That's just simply not true. As I say, if that really involves foretelling the future. And if somebody has that ability, they are certainly not telling you, not unless your name is like Warren Buffett or something. And so Harold Pollack, my co-writer, who's a professor at the University of Chicago, sort of laid out the case for investing in index funds, which are low-cost mutual funds and ETFs that mimic the stock market. And the studies show time and time again, because less than 1% of us, and this 1% includes everyone from you and me to people who manage hedge funds, have the ability to outguess the markets year in and year out, will do better for investors at much lower cost than following the advice of a financial guru on the radio or your cousin's financial planner, and so on down the line. And then finally, of course, the last chapter, as you've pointed out, was a plea to support the social safety net. Both Harold and I very strongly feel that people do not realize that their entire personal finance lives as they know it is really would not exist without the backstop of the government providing everything from Social Security to disability insurance and mortgage breaks and so on down the line.
Well, I'm afraid we're completely out of time. I've been speaking with journalist Helene Olin. She is the author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. She's also the co-author with Harold Pollack of The Index Card, Why Personal Finance Doesn't Have to Be Complicated. She's also the host of the podcast called The United States of Debt, and we have a link to those books and that podcast on our website, againstthegrain.org. Helene, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me on.
You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.